Two in the Middle. I'm Joey Block. Well, Friday night of last week, there was some big news that came down, and that was after the recording of this podcast. So we didn't get this in last week, but the news kind of trickled in to the following week, aka this week. The judge, Scott McAfee, in that Georgia Trump election trial, says the former president can appeal the decision to keep Fulton County District Attorney Fonnie Willis on the case. McAfee is allowing former President Trump, along with his co-defendants, to appeal the ruling to the Georgia Appellate Court of Appeals. In his court order, McAfee says he will, quote, continue addressing the many other unrelated pending pretrial motions, close quote, regardless of what the appellate court decides. In a statement, Trump's attorney Steve Sato says his team is optimistic this will lead to the case being not only dismissed, but that Willis herself will be disqualified. This comes a week after the judge ruled Willis could stay on the case just as long as the top prosecutor in the whole thing, Nathan Wade, working on behalf of the state, resigned. Well, he did just that hours after the ruling. The two admitted to having an affair, but the defense accused them both of romantically being involved before Wade joined the case and in the lead up to it, alleging Willis only hired him because he was her boyfriend. This whole case is something that has come out like a soap opera, as if you've been following it, as you probably know, because you had the whole Willis thing and the whole affair, and now the case is now becoming more about Willis and about Wade than it's becoming about Trump and the alleged crimes he committed in this election case. So if you're the DA, you probably don't want this. You probably want to go back to the way it was when you were filing all these charges and that Trump was having an answer for all of them. So, you know, for Willis, this is a particularly vicarious situation she's in because she's running for re-election this year. So she has to play the game of, you know, in a deep blue county, oh, I got to go get Trump. At the same time, got to keep her integrity as a DA in order to have confidence. So the voters have confidence in her as they go to the polls to re-elect her. She's got that complicated aspect. She has to deal with this. And of course, Trump himself is playing politics because even though he is the presumptive nominee for president or on the Republican side, he still has to go through the convention part, get the nomination officially, and then go on to the general election where he's going up against President Biden. So he has all that he has to lay out and work out. And right now he's been playing the game of, okay, if I keep hyping up these cases and that it's this two-tier justice system thing, that this is going to work for me. Well, if you did notice, throughout the primary, his lead did keep going up and up and up. Every time one of these things happened, he did end up getting more support within the primary itself. But the question is, does that carry over to the general election? Because the polling, you know, as that became more of a thing, didn't really pan out as much. So for Trump, he's got to be careful. Now, of course, there's a lot of polling out there showing him up ahead. But the question, the million-dollar question, is whether he is convicted, will the voters stick with him? The polling has suggested up till now that is probably not going to happen, that he could lose some. But again, real-world situations don't always play out the same way as the polling, as we have seen over the recent years. Will the voters care? That's only something we're going to be able to test if we get a conviction. In this case, at the moment, it remains uncertain whether Trump will actually face trial before Election Day. And how much Georgians in particular, which is a swing state, will factor this into their votes because there's a lot of other things going on in the state. What about the Lake and Riley death? That whole thing. Republicans are galvanizing on that because, as you know, she is the University of Georgia nursing student who was fatally killed by an alleged illegal migrant. So Republicans have been saying, well, you know, if the border was secure, the guy would have never gone in. And then also that he had previously been released after being imprisoned in New York. So then, of course, you got the cash bail thing. So Republicans are running with that one. And Trump himself met with the family. And the dad actually spoke out saying, well, you know, if the border was secure, this might not happen. So Republicans are going to use all that in the state of Georgia, because Brian Kemp, he's all on that train too, saying this is a tragedy and that Biden really needs to work on these border policies. It's all because of his failed policies. So Republicans have their narrative there between that and then to your adjusting. Democrats, they have to try and they have to hype this thing up. They got to pump this thing up saying, well, you know, Trump is really not, he's really not qualified. He tried to rig the election. This guy's no good. They have to go with the character argument because that seems to be the thing that Trump has struggled with the most, is that he is still somewhat unlikable. If you look at the polling, because a majority of Americans don't want either Biden nor Trump. So he has to try and now make himself more a likable guy. And to do that is, of course, to play a martyr. So he is going on the limb here and trying to say, well, you know, they're not just coming after me, they're coming after you. I'm just in between. That's what he's repeatedly said at his rallies. We'll have to see whether that argument works, especially in the state of Georgia, which is a must-win state for Trump in the Electoral College if he is to win another term in the White House. We'll be watching to see where that goes. But that's not the only legal trouble Trump is having to deal with here. In New York, the Attorney General there, Letitia James, is eyeing up one of former President Trump's properties in Westchester County to seize if he's unable to post bond money. According to records from the Westchester County Clerk, James registered judgments this month against Trump's Seven Springs estate, which is home to his 50,000 square foot mansion, along with one of his golf courses there. According to Bloomberg, James registered the judgments in Westchester against Trump, his company, aka the Trump Organization, along with two of his adult children. This comes as Trump faces a deadline to pay a $454 million bond for allegedly overstating the value of his real estate properties. If he doesn't pay up, Trump could risk the state coming in there with their authorities and seizing his assets while appealing the ruling in the New York civil fraud trial. Trump's attorneys have previously said he's having trouble getting the money to put up the bond. So for Trump, again, this is a legal quandary for him because this isn't a criminal thing. So it's not quite the same as Georgia where, you know, he could potentially be sitting in jail in the middle of an election, if not in the middle of a presidency. You know, we obviously have to look at the constitutional boundaries here to see how that would work. And I'm sure that will be worked out through the courts and everything along that line. But for this, this is a civil case. So this is all about money and being able to put up the cash in order to do it. Because, yes, people look at Trump's wealth and see, you know, he's in the billion category. So he's got money. But the problem for Trump, and that's what's being alleged here, and a lot of experts have said, that it's not all liquid cash. He's only got a handful of the fortune actually able to where he can liquidate it and hand some cash over to the state to pay up this thing. That a lot of it is tied up in real estate, in stocks, bonds, all these other things of investments where you can't just simply do it, because even selling off some of these properties could take months to do, that you can't just sell it off. And Trump even said on social media he'd have to go fire sale prices on these things if it comes down to it in order to meet the deadline. We'll have to see what he ends up doing. But he has reached out to a lot of large money donors of his campaign, and a lot of them have declined to help him. We'll have to see. Maybe someone will help him out. People who have a little more money in the bank, or more the case, money they can get to quickly, because it's all about getting money quick. But a lot of people in the court and in the state say that Trump's just buying time here. He's just making the whole thing up because he is worth $1 billion, and that he overinflated the value of these assets, especially when it comes to the real estate. So he actually has more money sitting around than we think, and that he can somehow liquidate it, which, again, that is what the state is alleging, the state of New York, Letitia James, the Attorney General's office, that could be. Now, there is a thought pattern to this that could make sense here. Trump could be trying to delay this for several reasons. One, he just wants to delay and buy time as he gets closer to the election, and then try and use presidential immunity, which, again, that case is being worked out in the Supreme Court, and that judgment's probably not going to come down until June, where we'll have to see where the Supreme Court puts limits on where a president, and in fact a former president, is immune from prosecution of any type of crime. We're going to have to look and see is whether that's solely for federal crimes or state crimes. We'll be watching for that ruling for sure. But in regards to the James thing, it could also be that he's playing politics, because this is a political thing, because James herself does have a little bit of motive, because James ran on Trump, you know, I'm going to go get him. I'm getting him. Because one woman, and I believe in a video she posted online, are you going to get him? Oh yeah, I'm going to get him. I'm going to be a pain as you know what. So there is that aspect of it, that this is good because she's in a blue state and they don't like Trump there in certain parts. Of course, if you go up upstate, they like him a little more. Staten Island, they like him. Long Island, go either way. In the city, of course, they don't really like him there. Of course, there are people that do. So it depends on where you go. But it's politically popular for her as someone who's eyeing up the governorship, because after all, she did run for a hot second there the last time around. Of course, then she got out once it became obvious that Hochul was going to be elected to a full term. Now, Hochul has said she wants term limits, so she may only run for one term. If that's the case, then that would be the opportunity for James to get in there and run. It's similar to how Andrew Cuomo got in. He was started out as an attorney general. Then there was a scandal that embroiled his predecessor, which resulted in them leaving. And then he ended up running for governor and winning. And he got a few terms out of that. So this could be a similar path that James is trying to take. And by taking down Trump, she can campaign. I'm the one who took Trump. I'm the one who fought against MAGA and all that stuff. So she could win on that. For Trump, he could be playing it up for his base. That look at these people from New York, these elitists, they're coming after me and my business. I built this city. I built that state. And regardless, they are coming after me. They're coming after business. This is just a state of tyranny. They will come after you the same way. Again, that could be an argument that is appealing to the people that are around him, but also the business community that could play to them. Now, what do you mean? Isn't it the same people who have always been watching him? Well, yeah, but have you noticed that someone high profile has been speaking out about all this? You know, a guy named Kevin Leary? Yeah, the Shark Tank guy. He has now been saying how bad this is for business in the state of New York City because, well, you know, everybody's going to do it. I mean, not only New York City, but New York State. A lot of the Wall Street guys do this. So if you go after Trump, you got to go after everybody. If everybody, then how can you do business in the state? He's warning that people are going to, you know, they're going to hightail it out of there and go to other states. And he says that the state of New York shouldn't be doing the whole thing. So he, you know, largely not really a guy who would speak on Trump's behalf. He's been going all over the place and doing it. So for Leary, this is, for Kevin O'Leary, this is a big deal that he's coming out. And it's getting a lot of financial people, you know, they're going to the edge of their seat here. They're paying attention to what this guy is saying. This could possibly signal what the business community is going to do going forward in the state of New York if they put certain regulations in place. So that's something we have to keep an eye on to see if Trump is able to get guys like that, not only to speak out on his behalf in case like, but then to bring them into his corner. If he's able to get endorsements from these kind of guys, then that might be a problem. And also could be a problem for Biden too, because Biden then might have to be put in the awkward situation of, maybe we shouldn't do this. Because, yeah, Biden has, you know, the Democratic Party has traditionally been a party that has spoken out against billionaires. A lot of money from Biden does come from Wall Street, because he is one of those centrist Democrat guys traditionally who has worked, you know, worked with the business community a little bit and has worked for corporations. But now, of course, Biden has proposed more taxes on corporations. They're not happy about it. And now that, you know, he's sitting by while a fellow member of his party, Letitia James, is going out there, going after collecting all this money from people who are just trying to do business in New York, that can be a problem. And then also the whole Trump claim of who was hurt in the case. That has been the messaging you've been hearing. Where's the victim? The victimless crime. And that's something James is really, if she wants to bring this home for a political case, has got to make the argument of who is the victim in this case? Who are the victims? Who were the people who were hurt by Trump committing fraud? What were the banks' reactions? Because, you know, Trump's claiming, oh, these banks loved it. They didn't care. You know, they got their money. That's all they cared about. So if you want to combat that argument, you're going to have to put up some people who say they were. Now, of course, the trial's over, so really this is all about the appeal that James would have to fight this battle, and also court of public opinion if she were to seek higher office. Then there's also the case of, you know, remember the Mar-a-Lago raid? Remember? That was another case. That was a criminal case where they were having this whole back and forth about Trump and these classified documents. The government wanted him to hand them over, and Trump refused, saying, nope, I'm not doing that. And it was this big battle between him and the National Archives, to the point where the FBI and the DOJ decided to take matters in their own hands. When negotiations broke down, they just decided to raid the place. They went down to Mar-a-Lago and started digging around for documents in a 13-hour raid. Well, you may recall, Donald Trump gained a lot of momentum after that, because he got a lot of money coming into the campaign after that raid, and made it look like that this tyrannical government was coming after him. It could be a school of thought, and we have no fact to back this up at all, that he wants them to come into that house of his up in Westchester, and they want him to raid the place. They want that to be seized. They want the image of the cops showing up at the home with the SWAT team saying, you know, Mr. President, we got to get you out of here. This is no longer your property. You're done. Get out. He may want that, because after all, he doesn't spend that much time up in Westchester. He's usually in Bedminster, or he's down in Mar-a-Lago in Palm Beach, Florida. Usually those are his regular places. Occasionally he'll go to Trump Tower, but because of security issues, he usually doesn't stay there anymore. So it's one of the two. But, you know, he may just show up there for the hell of it and just see what the guys do. So there could be that strategy. He wants the imagery. It could boost campaign funding for him, also bolster the support he has, and maybe possibly extend himself to people who, you know, traditionally wouldn't vote for him but are skeptical of the justice system, that they see something they don't like about it, and they see Trump as this kind of symbolism for what it could be, that, You know, if they're going to go after this billionaire guy, what's stopping them from coming after a guy like me or a gal like me? So that will be the question of the politics behind this. Is it James that ends up benefiting in the long run in the end of this, or will it be Trump? We'll get a preview of this in November, obviously, and on the James end, we'll find out in the coming years what happens to her. Well, it is official. Senator Bob Menendez will not be running in the Democratic primary this year. He made the announcement in a video posted online saying, quote, "Unfortunately, the present accusations I am facing, of which I am innocent and will prove so, will not allow me to have that type of dialogue and debate with potential opponents that have already made it the cornerstone of their campaign. New Jerseyans deserve better than that." Close quote. Well, despite declining to run in this year's primary, the senator isn't ruling out launching a re-election campaign as an independent. In the video, he said, quote, "I am hopeful that my exoneration will take place this summer and allow me to pursue my candidacy as an independent Democrat in the general election." Close quote. This comes as multiple outlets have been reporting he would not run for re-election as a Democrat, with NBC News saying this just last week. They were reporting he was considering this independent bid. As an independent candidate, he would not need to file until June 4th and would only need 800 signatures as opposed to 1,000 required to run as a Democrat. The filing deadline for the Democratic primary is just days away. Menendez is facing 18 obstruction of justice and bribery charges. His approval rating currently sits as low as single digits, according to some polls. So, Menendez, this is the thing we've been trying to work through here the last couple of weeks on the show, is where Menendez is in the game here. Whether he's running as a Democrat, he's running as an independent, is he running at all? Well, we kind of have some clarity here. Not the full story, but this is the first time we really heard Menendez explicitly talk about this, where he said, first time, he's not running the Democratic primary. So this primary is pretty much set here. It's going to be New Jersey First Lady Tammy Murphy and New Jersey 3rd Congressional District Congressman Andy Kim. These are the main players. Of course, you have Patrizia Campos Medina in there, and you have Larry Hamm also there too. And there's also another candidate who's lesser known in this thing, but he isn't really campaigning. He just kind of jumped in very recently, so he's not really a player at the moment. So you have all these people. This is the field. This is who the Democrats have to choose from here. And as you know, Andy Kim was kind of freaking out about this last week. He was saying, now this is a disgrace, and that, you know, a third party bid, that just hands it over to the Republicans in a state that hasn't gone for a Republican in a Senate race since 1972. So Kim was a little concerned on that. Tammy Murphy, not as much. She was kind of like, I'm not really concerned about this. I'm not thinking about this right now. I'm just concerned about winning the race. So she's all into the primary thing. These people are the choices. And for Menendez to be considering an independent bid, there's a couple of interesting factoids to that of why he may be doing such a thing on top of that. Because like I said, his approval rating isn't great. It's not like he's got this great approval rating in the state and among independents, and it's just the Democrats don't want him, either the voters and the base, or just the establishment doesn't want him. It's all the people in New Jersey at the moment. The Democrats don't want him, the independents don't want him, and you know the Republicans don't want him. So his main base right now are people in Hudson County, and he can't even convince the Democrats up there to give him a chance. So this independent bid would be an interesting one at that. It would, like he said, he would have to be exonerated, or at the very least, you know, not found guilty. Because this trial is happening in May. May 6th is the start date. So he's only got about a month, and or actually less, to decide whether he's going to file in between the start date to where the filing date is. So that would determine whether Menendez would actually get to decide, because he may not have a verdict by June 4th. This trial may go on long. You never know where the trials go. I mean, I know there's an expected amount of time supposed to last, but we saw that with the civil fraud trial. It was only supposed to last 4 to 6 weeks. It ended up going much longer than that. It happens. You find new evidence. You get another witness on the stand. You know, there's new things to consider. So Menendez would essentially have to go in blind, not knowing whether he's going to be guilty or not, or at least file. But there are a couple reasons why Menendez would want to do this. Well, number one, he's a fighter. He's not a guy who gives up. He could have all 99 of those Democrats in the Senate calling on him to resign, and he'd still be sitting there saying, well, I got more juice in my gas tank here, and I'm going to keep going. So if you have that to consider with Menendez, he's not someone who gives up easy. And the way he can fight back is an independent bid where he doesn't have to rely on party leaders to get behind him. He doesn't have to play to certain issues to get the Democratic vote. He doesn't have to get grassroots progressives to get behind him. He's just got to talk to the regular men and women in New Jersey and try and get them on his side. And there is a large pool of unaffiliated voters. They don't all necessarily lean left or even center. You know, some of them are right-leaning independents that he would have to try and bring over to his side, which may be more difficult. So Menendez would have to put a unique coalition together. One, he would have to pull away the votes from whoever the Democratic nominee is, and then also bring in his own coalition. He would have to bring in the undecideds and the independents, the people in the middle. People go from election to election. Again, the Senate race was not as many of those people. He would have to pull all those votes over from the Democrats, which would be a tall order. Like I said, he would have to be a reputation thing. He, in the video, he did talk a lot about his policy accomplishments. He talked about getting money to the state for COVID. He talked about Superstorm Sandy federal aid that he was able to bring into the state, that he fought for all that. He spoke about all the big issues that he was talking about. You know, the Affordable Care Act, the Gateway Tunnel, all this stuff he said he advocated for. And he's trying to make that policy argument of, okay, well, listen, I know things don't look great right now, but look at what I did for you as New Jerseyans, not as a Democrat necessarily, but as a New Jerseyan. Look at what I did for you. This is something I can do for you no matter what, even as an independent. Although he's still going to be a registered Democrat, he's just going to be running not on the Democratic ticket. So he's going to be in his own little bracket of the line. So just to make things more complicated. But again, he could try to make the argument of, well, I've been here, I'm the loyal fighter for you, come be loyal for me, and I'm not going to let the party determine who's going to win this race, and also what New Jerseyans are going to care about. We'll have to see if that aspect works for Menendez. But then there's the other part. Because the interesting way the law's written campaign-wise is that he can use his campaign funds to pay for his legal bills as long as he's still in the race. So he had monster fundraising quarters leading up to this. Obviously, the fourth quarter was lagging behind those. But he still had millions of dollars of cash on hand that he could use to pay off for this. So if he's able to fundraise while this is all going on, even if he doesn't end up running, or if he drops out somewhere in the middle of all this, once all the hell breaks loose here and it comes crashing down on him, if he gets a guilty verdict, he can pay off a lot of these legal bills and not have to personally pay for it himself. So he's got that aspect of it, that he can still keep fundraising and doing it. Now, finding people to cut the checks, that's a little more difficult. He would have to find people who have been loyal to him since his start in politics and, you know, liked what he's done as a senator, and he would have to go convince those guys, hey, listen, I know you're probably behind Tammy Murphy and Andy Kim right now, but why don't you close the checkbook on them and open it up for me? That would be a challenge for him because, again, the Democratic voter base and the donor class, they're used to supporting their nominee. They'd have to come to him. He does have the relationships, but whether, you know, with a federal indictment hanging over you, that can be a little more difficult to do, especially if the trial is not looking like it's going in his direction. That could be a problem. And then, of course, obviously, if he gets convicted, that changes the whole game right there, too. Like I said, we'll be watching to see if he can accomplish that, because he did get out of his past legal troubles. Last time it ended up in a hung jury, and then they were getting ready to retry the case, and the judge just dismissed the whole thing. That's what he'd have to do, but he tried to get this judge to dismiss everything, but it didn't really work out for him this time. So, for Menendez, he would have to hope that his lawyers have the good defense and that he can fight off this battle. Again, we'll be watching all this and seeing where this all goes. But here's what we're getting in the middle of this week. The federal judge handling Congressman Andy Kim's county organizational line lawsuit is expressing skepticism of both sides. He held a hearing this week on that whole lawsuit. He started out by saying that he wasn't going to consider State Attorney General Matt Platkin's letter that declares that the state's not going to get involved in this at all. And in fact, that he says the line is unconstitutional. The judge says that Platkin is essentially just trying to inject his opinion into the case without actually being part of the case. Well, in opening statements, attorneys for the county clerks who were named in the suit accused Congressman Kim of deliberately filing at a hard time for them and warned the judge of legislating from the bench, which he pushed back against that because he wasn't a big fan of that. He kind of interrupted them a little bit in their opening statements compared to the attorneys on the other side. The judge also wasn't buying the argument that those attorneys were making that this would all be chaos if this line was all of a sudden thrown out. Kim himself took the stand where he said he's been forced to participate in the process in order to succeed in his political career, despite his personal feelings about it, where he's not really a big fan of the line. Kim says getting rid of the county organizational line would create a fairer system. This comes as an amicus brief was filed supporting Kim's lawsuit by Hoboken Mayor Robbie Bala and a Democratic candidate who's looking to replace Kim in Congress, Joe Cohn, along with other current and former state officials and other politicians throughout the state. Cohn did not win any of the county organizational lines in his campaign for Congress, but he says he's the one who can heal the partisan divide in Congress. Cohn says he wants to serve for all Americans, regardless of political party, and he wants to serve those in his district and constituents who are Democrats, Republicans, Independents, or whatever. He just wants to serve you. Well, joining me now is the candidate himself, New Jersey 3rd District Democratic Congressional candidate Joe Cohn. Joe, thanks for coming on.
Thank you so much, Joey, for having me.
I want to talk about your briefing that you recently filed in this whole county organizational line lawsuit. It's a big deal. It could affect the whole political aspect of the state. But before we get to that, I have to mention a significant thing going on in your life right now. You're running for Congress in New Jersey's 3rd Congressional District. What made you decide to jump into this race?
Well, that's right. I have practiced civil rights law for the last, 20 years. And the last 12 of which I've been focused on fighting for free speech rights of people on every part of the political spectrum. And in that work, you go across the country and whichever side has the majority, you're almost always telling them, please don't censor your opponents, because that's how censorship works. People censor the people they disagree with. And it didn't matter whether I was on a college campus or whether I was in a state legislature or in the halls of Congress or just everyday interactions, you know, with people on the streets. Everywhere you turn, there's just heavy weight of the polarization that we're facing as a country. And I was getting really concerned about the direction we're going. I'm running, you know, as a Democrat, and I am concerned about what I view as a growing insurrectionist movement. And I didn't want to wake up years from now wondering what I could have done to help fight for our democracy when this moment seems so serious and seems like a tipping point. And when I talk about fighting for democracy, I'm not just talking about narrower restrictions on voting. I'm also talking about attempts to restrict what can be taught in college classrooms. I'm talking about attacks on the press. I'm talking about systematic attempts to dismantle checks and balances on government. So I was thinking about all of those things, and I felt like my skill set of working across party lines would be very valuable in Congress today.
You talk about your work in advocating for political causes that you cared about. You've been doing that for years now, but it's important to note that you've never held public office before compared to some of the other people that you are running against. How do you see your experience translating to Congress? What are you bringing to the table that your opponents are not bringing?
Frankly, I think my experience is much more valuable because the voters aren't sending someone to Trenton where there's been one party control for many years. They're sending someone to Washington, D.C., where, you know, whether you're on the right or where you're on the left, both parties have leverage of power. And I've been working at the Foundation for Individual Rights and Expression, or better known as FIRE, doing that free speech work in nearly every state in the country. And I've had to persuade people when I didn't have the math on my side. So last year, I led a charge against a DeSantis-backed bill that would have undermined press freedoms in that state. I didn't have the votes naturally by just relying on Democrats to kill the bill. I needed to persuade Republicans that it wasn't in their best interest to move it forward, and did. Countless other examples I could provide. You know, I've defended tenure in, you know, in Texas, and defended, you know, academic freedom in North Dakota, and fought, you know, to oppose legislation in North Dakota that would have made it criminal for a university employee to bring a pro-choice speaker onto a college campus in that state. And, you know, I wrote to the governor there and got a line item veto. In all of these examples, I didn't have the math. I had to persuade. And right now, that's what Congress needs. It needs people that can work across party lines for common good. And none of my opponents have successfully been able to do that. So they're good people. I'm not going to say an ill word about them. If I were a legislator, I'd be proud of my record, too. But what Democrat in a majority Democrat state hasn't been able to protect the right to choose?
Let's talk about your opponents in particular. You're going up against South Jersey heavyweights Carol Murphy and Herb Conaway. Conaway has won all the county organizational lines in the district. They both have a lot more money and name recognition behind them than you do. You talk about math, and the math is right now that they would have the advantage in this race. I know you said you've been able to defy math before, but the reality is the numbers here, they're going to be pretty hard to beat. How do you plan on competing against them?
Well, one, I don't know that the county line is going to exist by the time this election takes place. So let's just, you know, put a pin in that for now. But second, you know, we don't know what the financials are going to look like until the next reporting period comes on in. And, you know, I am doing my best to raise funds the way I suspect my opponents are. And, you know, we'll find out in a few weeks where that horse race is. The bottom line is I have a short period of time to introduce myself to voters. But I'm convinced that as I do, they're going to like what they hear from me, because I'm someone that treats voters with respect and gives them real answers to questions and tries to treat all voters as if they have value and that it isn't just an us versus them society.
Specifically on the campaign financing end, you think you're going to be able to compete with them enough? Do you have high dollar fundraisers? How are you raising this money that you believe is going to be competitive with them?
Well, I've, you know, worked on civil liberties issues across the whole country. So I have, you know, people who are excited about, you know, seeing someone who has fought as hard for Republican free speech as I have for Democrat free speech. And, you know, I have kind of inroads in with civil libertarians that my opponents just don't have. So it's going to be interesting. And, you know, this is a situation, you know, you can't just assume that a state legislator is going to run away with this. They don't have a huge history of raising much money either. And in their first several weeks in the campaign, neither one of them cracked $50,000 in fundraising. So we're not exactly talking about opposing juggernauts. And, you know, we're going to see where it goes. I think really this is a contest of ideas, though. And that's what I want to focus on. I think I'm the better candidate because I think I bring the right skill set to the table now.
Do you think you'll be able to crack 50,000 to 100,000 based on the numbers that you're getting by the time filing is done?
I've already done that. So, you know, I think, you know, frankly, this is really going to have to come down to ideas and who gets their message out to voters and who has a more compelling, you know, argument. And truth be told, as voters get a chance to get to know me, I think they'll like what they have to hear. I mean, no, there's no candidate that will ever, you know, match every single voter on every single issue to a T. There are so many important and difficult issues that we all need to face. But I think in a Democratic primary, I've done a heck of a lot of things that Democrats will be proud of. You know, I started my career at the AIDS Law Project of Pennsylvania doing HIV and AIDS housing cases. I'm a former legal director of two ACLU affiliates, where I've done every kind of civil rights work, from LGBTQ work to racial profiling work to prisoner civil rights work. And, you know, my opponents don't quite have the depth of experience in civil liberties that I bring to the table.
You talk about how you have a lot of connections across the country, specifically on the civil liberties issue. What type of donors are you having particularly to your campaign? Are they high dollar donors? Are they people just donating $30 or less? What does that look like for you?
Oh, it's a mixture. You know, I have, you know, plenty of donors that are contributing, you know, $25. But also, several that are kicking in at 250 and some at 1,000, you know, it's a mixture. And, you know, and that's the way it should be. The truth be told, it shouldn't be that, you know, that races are determined by campaign finance. And I still don't think that you can buy a victory in a race today, but you sure can lose one by not being able to get out your message. And I'm working hard to make sure that we reach out to civil libertarians. And if you're listening, if you care about the First Amendment and you care about other civil liberties, you know, I hope you consider checking out my website, learning about my different platforms, and maybe even contributing, you know, whatever you can afford as well, because that's really what this comes down to. We need to get our message out, and we're going to work hard to do it.
You frequently mentioned throughout our conversation civil libertarians. Libertarian is someone who may not necessarily consider themselves a Democrat. In fact, in many cases these days, over the last several years, they might lean more to the right. Where do you consider yourself on the ideological spectrum? Do you consider yourself a progressive, a moderate, maybe something a little closer to the right? Where do you see yourself on the political spectrum?
Well, so civil libertarian is not the same as libertarian, the political party. Civil libertarian is about, you know, constitutional rights and that issue alone. But, you know, where I stand on the spectrum is, you know, issue by issue, I'm progressive in some ways, I'm moderate in others. And my tagline is progressive where that's productive and moderate where it matters. And that's because we really need to think about what we can actually get done as a society together. I was organizing events, you know, for LGBTQ rights, including gay marriage, when I was, you know, in college in the 90s, well before, you know, Hillary Clinton, Bill Clinton, or either of the Obamas supported that, as an issue. But I also think that we need to have a big tent. You know, the Democratic Party needs to be a party that is welcoming of people who want to move America forward, care about making sure that people are treated fairly, middle-class people and low-income people finding a way to provide more opportunity. We need to be a party that's defined on our by our ability to advance equality and justice, but also economic opportunity for all.
You said earlier that the county organizational line may not exist come June 4th when the primaries take place. Last week, you filed an amicus brief along with four other current and former office holders, including Hoboken Mayor Ravi Bala, in support of Congressman Andy Kim's lawsuit challenging the county organizational line. What compelled you to file this brief?
Well, one of the main themes of my campaign, as I said earlier, is that now is a time where democracy is really at great risk. But if we're going to be a party of defending democracy, we need to be one that makes sure that we actually walk the walk. And the county line is anything but that. And to be clear for a moment, it isn't just Democrats in New Jersey that use the county line. The county line system is used by Republicans as well in their primaries. But the Democratic Party is grappling with it because it's so inconsistent with our overall messaging that elections need to be fair for all. And for those of you listeners who don't know what the county line is, New Jersey is the only state in the country that allows party bosses to decide what ballots will look like. So usually when you're competing for your party's endorsement, it comes with some bragging rights. You can say on your website, you know, the Democratic Party of, you know, my county endorsed me. They might even choose to send out a mailer to voters saying as much. They might steer volunteers your way. But what they don't do anywhere else is decide to lump the people that they prefer together in a system called bracketing, so that the voter's eye goes naturally to all of those people in one column or in one row. And any other candidate, because you're talking about a primary, all of the candidates are members of the same party, steering, you know, other candidates far into what's called ballot Siberia, where it's several phones over, and, you know, and you don't even realize necessarily that they're running for the same office. So in other states, you'd see, you know, all of the candidates for president, and then all of the candidates for Senate, and then all of the candidates for the House of Representatives, and so on and so on. And this process is a blatant attempt to manipulate the voters.
Now, there's been a similar case that's been playing out in court for years. Why is there time to file this lawsuit now that you're supporting here? Because we've had this other one that's been in court for the last few years now. Why is now the time to file another one?
Well, Andy Kim's campaign chose to take a different strategy towards their lawsuit, and they have asked for an injunction. An injunction says that we, you know, when you're asking for an injunction, you're asking the court to step in immediately because of the allegation being that there's irreparable harm if this proceeds any further. The other lawsuits are over campaigns that have ended and already. So they can't file for an injunction, you know, at the moment, because they're for candidates that aren't currently running for office. So that's the why now.
A group of four bipartisan county clerks have called on the federal judge in this case to not intervene in the election ballot process while the campaign is ongoing. In a letter to the judge, Hunterdon County Clerk Mary Melfi, Gloucester County Clerk James Hogan, Cape May County Clerk Rita Rothberg, and Cumberland County Clerk Celeste Riley say it is too late to change things now, claiming a ruling against the line would upend the political process here in New Jersey negatively. In court this week, we had the attorney who was representing these county clerks, Angelo Genova, claiming that the letter in which the Attorney General of the state of New Jersey, Matt Plotkin, wrote a few days leading into this, that it's a litigation grenade and that this should not be considered in this case at all. Are you concerned that possibly changing the lineup in the middle of a campaign might cause some problems at the county level when it comes to printing out these ballots?
No. I mean, it is so easy to do with the software to just change it to a block vote like everywhere else in the country does it. And quite frankly, they've known about the lawsuit for several weeks. It's a question of which one are they going to click the print button on. Their argument strains credibility. And quite frankly, when you're talking about something that might be unconstitutional and interfere with the right to vote, kicking it down the can because of inconvenience for county clerks is something that I doubt the court will take too seriously once they weigh in.
New Jersey Senate candidate Congressman Andy Kim is the one spearheading this lawsuit. He's the guy currently representing your district in Congress. Is it safe to say you're supporting him in the primary?
I think he's been a great congressman, and he would represent the state well.
Do you plan on endorsing him?
I'm going to be talking to him soon, and stay tuned.
Do you plan on talking to New Jersey First Lady Tammy Murphy as well, or just the congressman?
I've had a brief conversation with her, and I'm happy to have another one with her too. But Andy Kim has represented the 3rd District incredibly well, and it would be hard-pressed for the First Lady to win my support over Representative Kim, because he's done a great job on this issue on the line.
I want to go to something that you brought up earlier about your party. You say, quote, we need to have a big tent. And this issue of the big tent and what the issues in the platform should be of the party has come under debate in recent years, particularly when it comes to the war in Israel. There has been a growing debate within your party about how to address the war in Gaza. Some say there should be a ceasefire in the West Bank, while others claim the U.S. needs to provide more aid to Israel to help the Jewish state continue on with this war. The Biden administration is working towards a hostage deal that would include a temporary ceasefire, but many progressives, including Michigan Congresswoman Rashida Tlaib, say this doesn't go far enough. They want to have a permanent ceasefire in place. Should this be a litmus test in your party? Is it that you gotta be for a ceasefire or you're kicked out? What are your thoughts on that?
I mean, I hope not, because there are so many crucial challenges facing the world, and so many important things that we need to be able to address. I think ultimately in Israel and Gaza, we need to be focused on building a long-term peace. Israelis deserve security. Palestinians deserve economic opportunity and civil rights, and deserve to be able to chart their own course forward. But that can't happen while Hamas or any other violent terrorist groups are calling the shots there. A ceasefire that doesn't include returning the hostages and having violent terrorists step down from power isn't going to cause any lasting peace. That's just a recipe for when's the next attack going to happen and when's the next blowup going to happen. So I think the United States has an important role to play in ensuring that Israel can reduce civilian deaths as much as possible, in encouraging them to take pauses so humanitarian aid can get in, so that journalists can do their job, so that medical professionals can treat civilians. But ultimately, a permanent ceasefire here, while Hamas is still in charge, and while hostages are still held isn't going to reduce deaths over the long run. It's just going to perpetuate the violence. So we all need to be on the same page in terms of trying in good faith to bring stability to that region and to improve the lives of all of the people that are there who want to live in peace with each other. That's got to be the focus.
The funding of this war has become an issue, particularly in Congress. Every Democratic member of the New Jersey congressional delegation in the House has signed onto a petition that would discharge a Senate foreign aid bill onto the floor for a vote. The bill includes funding for not only Israel, but also Ukraine and Taiwan. If you were in the House right now, would you sign that discharge petition?
I think funding needs to go to all three of those, you know, countries. I mean, I do not trust Vladimir Putin to stop at the Ukraine. We have too much history in Europe to believe that dictators can be appeased by just ceding territory to them. And as much as it, you know, takes out of the American treasury now to support Ukraine, it's a way better financial option than waiting till Ukraine has already fallen, seeing that Putin is going further into Europe and having to contemplate whether or not we need boots on the ground. So my view is that the United States needs to support its allies, particularly when they're facing dangerous threats.
Now, in regards to this discharge petition, just to give some context to it, it would essentially force a vote on a bill that the House leadership would not be a big fan of, because right now the House Speaker Mike Johnson hasn't really committed to bringing that to the floor. But a simple majority, which can be made up of both Democrats and Republicans, would force a vote on this. Do you think that there needs to be a vote for us, that we can't just wait for House leadership to put that bill on the floor, that this discharge petition is the only way to do it?
I don't know that it's the only way to do it, you know, in terms of time travel being impossible and all other options being impossible. But I'll tell you that the Republican majority has had plenty of opportunity to make sure that it was going to step to the plate and hasn't yet. And this seems to be the most likely vehicle to make sure our allies get the aid that they need.
So you would support it, correct?
Yes.
Now, before we go, I want to touch on a big subject that has really been something that's been a debate within both parties, and that is TikTok. The House passed a bill that would ban TikTok in the United States if its parent company, ByteDance, doesn't sell off its American assets within 6 months. Is that something you would have voted for if you were in the House right now?
No, I mean, it was unconstitutional. And I try not to vote for, try not to support unconstitutional things. So here's the deal. I think we are all right to be concerned about Chinese influence over social media. But at the same time, that bill won't actually solve the full problem, because what it would do is it would force the Chinese government to sell its interest the company that owns it, its ties to China, to sell its interest. But the Chinese government could still buy that same data that it's allegedly mining from the app on the open market, because we don't have across the board privacy requirements. And that's really the answer under the First Amendment, is that you can't close off a full market and a full forum for speech that millions of people use to express themselves when you have other smaller, more narrowly tailored solutions to solve the problem you're trying to fix. And you could solve the same problem by having across the board privacy requirements that apply to everyone, because it's not like China's the only threat or other foreign nations are the only threat here. Privacy concerns affect us, even if it's private corporations that are buying our data.
Well, we'll have to see where this TikTok debate goes, whether the Senate picks it up, and we'll also be following your campaign. New Jersey 3rd District Democratic congressional candidate Joe Cohn. Thank you so much for joining me. Really appreciate it.
Thank you so much, Joey.
Well, thank you so much for listening. It has been a pleasure. We'll be back again next week with more In the Middle right here on Fox Sports New Jersey.